mystified me.
And I think that's why, for me, Galen is really a fascinating character. You know, mm-hmm. I'm educated in literature, so, right. And as a psychotherapist now, I still think in terms of character. You know, I mean, it's like I'm still reading novels. You know? And that, it's, in a way, he's like really in the American grain, you know? Mm-hmm. That there is no contradiction. You're seeing a contradiction. Mm-hmm. You're wrestling with the contradiction. Mm-hmm. You're trying to delineate it. Mm-hmm. But the people involved, there was no contradiction. And I mean, I think stateside, there was no contradiction for people who supported the war. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's something very clear, or maybe it was fuzzy, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there was, and anyway, it was, it's something that mystified me then.
Oh, two lumps. Thank you.
And just personally, I realize I've let go of that kind of mystification. You know, I mean, it's not, I no longer seem to be wrestling with the fact that other people think differently than I do mm-hmm. and that they really live in a different set of values mm-hmm. or that they just don't see the problems in the world that I see or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, but anyway, at the time, that kind of, and I think that was a big, I mean, there were those of us who wrestled mm-hmm. with the moral questions, and there were those who seemed to be just immune from them, blissfully immune. What's the problem? You know, and I think that priest was kind of like that, you know, what's the problem, son?
Well, one person put it very well. It was Howard Lewin. He said something like, hey, come on, this is a real world. You know, the communists have people doing this up there. We're doing it down here. Okay, so there's a Cold War. What has it got to do with what we're doing? Hmm. And I wrestle with that. There are interesting problems. You're in another country. There are consequences. One English teacher said, you know, when I look back, all I feel is that we set up targets for the path at WoW when they took over.
That's one that what just about really that? Worries me. Mm-hmm. That's when the path at WoW took over, mm-hmm. that was my main concern. Wow. We just set them up. You know, and, boy, I don't know what to do with that one. Because they were identified with us. Mm-hmm. They even took on some of our values, you know, especially the people we worked closely with. Mm-hmm. You know, they were westernized. Yeah. Unless there was a more human level to it, but I don't think it works that way. You know, I mean, unless there's a level of, you know, understanding that, well, this guy worked for, if there's a atmosphere of reconciliation, but I don't think that's the way it was.
Unfortunately, the Path of Lao were as ideologically pure as it was within their national mm-hmm. context as they could be. And that was, of course, the worst thing for any revolution is it ceases to be one, mm-hmm. which is why Thomas Jefferson said, every generation we need a little revolution. But what did you do after you left Moss? The short or the long version. We'll come back to it. We're not leaving Moss forever.
Well, I just want to give you an impression. Which uh-huh. We landed in Seattle. Uh-huh. And I remember going out to the Space Needle. And this was after coming from a village with like three or four motor vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And two-story was big.
Yeah. And there was a, something considered, there was like a freak show or something going on in this place. And it was just like incredible experiences coming back to this country and landing in that. Mm-hmm. We went to Berkeley. We moved back in there, and I found a job working in a hospital. Because I still had alternate service.
Because you weren't finished with your 2 years.
I wasn't finished with my 2 years. Okay. So I worked in Highland Hospital in East Oakland. Mm-hmm. And I was ended up going to another foreign country. I was the only white janitor on this crew. And so I really left that. And we left really raw. I think we were both extremely raw, and Susan was physically ill, and there was a whole period of trying to track that down with doctors on this side, and some battles with workman's comp for whether they would cover it or not. You know, there was some conflict over that. But that was somehow resolved, I forget how. The hippie thing was happening. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural history that's a very important element of this. You know, as I remember, one of the things that we happened with us is we hooked up with the International Hitchhiker set in Vientiane. Mm-hmm. And this was like mainly kind of a marijuana connection. Mm-hmm. You know, I got very, I'm not sure how long this went on, but it started, discovered marijuana in the open market, you know, and became kind of a connoisseur of it. I was amazed at how people got stoned when I came back to this country, because I was very intentional about it. And it came from that whole Timothy Leary mystical experience, drug, hallucinogen trip, you know, psychedelic thing. So it was always with some kind of purpose, expanding consciousness. But anyway, kind of connected spontaneously with some people on one of those trips to Vientiane with some people who were hitchhikers and were just there because the dope was good. And I remember being exposed to what was that magazine that
High Times?
No, it was I want to say Encounter, but it wasn't Encounter. It was published out of Marin. It was not a hippie magazine. Mm-hmm. It was one that dealt with all kinds of new. Anyway, they did one on the Haight-Ashbury, and it was like amazing to see what this was happening. And that was just an amazing thing. So I think part of my fantasy life was just fascinated with the possibility of a cultural revolution on a world scale. You know. And that it was going to happen spontaneously, people meeting each other, and being in different kinds of relationships with each other, and they were all on these voyages of self-discovery, and da-da-da-da-da, you know. So we came back to that, and found old friends in Berkeley who had moved along with that, and were in their phase of that, artists, passionate artists. And then there was still the political, we knew people who were still political, so there was a kind of tug, but we were more and more identifying ourselves with this hippie thing, even though people would argue that we weren't hippies or whatever, you know. So that was happening. And in that, Susan was pregnant with our first child, and I got a job at Highland Hospital, found myself in this other country. And it was very exciting. You know, I mean, I really loved that work. I was really glad to leave it when I left it. But it was just as rich a cultural exchange, although it was even more of a war going on. I was working in the emergency room when the Black Panthers got shot up. So I kind of, at some distance, experienced that, you know, that there was all these police and people on stretchers, and I think they shot up, I think Cleaver got shot in that, or somebody, one of those guys had been shot in that, so. And that was very political in the sense of something happening in this country, and, but not in the sense of free speech movements and that stuff, but more that there was a cultural revolution happening, and so it was important for us to live our lives in a way that facilitated that.
And of course, there's the inevitable. And then what happened?
Yeah,
and then what happened?
And then, our first daughter was born, and she was born with a major birth defect, which kind of blew a lot of our ideology out of the water, in that we were doing natural childbirth and all this stuff, and she was dependent upon medical interventions.
Right, all the lift, all modern cons,
yeah,
high tech,
yeah,
the whole nine
yeah.
yards.
So that was quite a, that's one I've never quite worked through.
A good shaman, of course, would have avoided all that.
Yeah. Well, that's the fact, is that it wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's, I would want to believe that, but in fact.
Well, breech birth is a breech birth. It's not like somebody can make it go away.
Yeah. Yeah. So that happened, and we moved to the country. Mm-hmm. We moved up to Mendocino County. Mm-hmm. We lived in a small town.
What was the name of the town?
Elk.
Elk. Okay.
Yeah. With people we'd known from Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And kind of IBS was in the past. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were first in Berkeley, though, that we were full of it. We were full of the experience of having lived there. We were full of the eating the food, preparing the food for friends, and also the anguish of Brett's assassination.
Still with you?
Yeah, it was still with you. Yeah. We were recovering.
Mm-hmm. One IBSer remarked that the first thing he noticed in the United States, being very, having a hard time readjusting, was there was this sign that told them to walk or don't walk. They didn't have that when he went out.
Yeah.
When he came back. And it's true, I remember that distinctly, that one day there were no such signs. And then little by little, on more streets, those signs appeared. And everything was different now. Now you were staring at these words instead of this color. And
I don't remember that.
Something had changed. Of course, now it's a computer.
Yeah.
The computer has the same kind of impact.
Yeah.
But you didn't stay in Elk.
For 6 years there.
Mm-hmm.
And then came down to Carmel Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all our children in Elk.
Mm-hmm.
And then raised them through grade school in Carmel Valley, mm-hmm. and then Pacific Grove, mm-hmm. kind of in this area,
mm-hmm.
been in this area since. You want to go further?
The whole story, getting you to what you're doing now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, and then there's some different business ventures, mm-hmm. or different mm-hmm. career ventures in all of this. In Elk, I became, mainly because it was available and because of my inclination, I became a gardener, and mm-hmm. then I became a head gardener, and then I, at a resort,
mm-hmm.
and then started a nursery. It was a nursery that sold books, nursery bookstore.
Uh-huh.
Selling rare garden perennials, natives, and natural history books.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't do very well at that at all, and sold that for a nominal sum, and came down to Carmel Valley and got involved in another nursery. The proprietor of a rare plants nursery there for a few years, and undercapitalized, and I'm not much of a businessman,
mm-hmm.
and a big drought hit, and that the business fell, that we couldn't maintain it. It was interesting. And I'd often, when I was in the midst of that horticultural stage, I'd often wish that I'd had that perspective when I'd been in Laos, because
mm-hmm.
I really wasn't aware of the vegetation in the way that I would have been. So then from that, still in Carmel Valley, I moved into landscape design and actually went to graduate school, or an extension program, and got a certificate in landscape architecture,
mm-hmm.
and did a lot of design work for contractors,
mm-hmm.
A friend contractor. Then moved to Pacific Grove, and then when Susan and I split up, I was still doing landscape design, and there was a cabinet maker in there somewhere too,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's right, in Carmel Valley,
mm-hmm.
when the nursery
folded.
I got a job with a friend again, and learned cabinetry and became quite proficient at that in small kind of garage. Actually, we rented barns and spaces like this, you know, and made custom cabinets. And so I was quite enthusiastic as an artisan. And then after that, went back to landscape design. So then I kind of flipped back and forth between that. I actually did sometimes I did it both at once. I'd be working on jobs in the garage and also drawing landscape stuff. Just all at a kind of a survival level. This is, none of this is bringing in a lot of money, you know, but making ends meet. So then when Susan and I broke up, which was, you know, a tumultuous kind of thing, we'd been married 18 years.
And you both are so calm. It's the impression that married couples always get.
Yeah, yes. I thought we really had a good front, you know, and realized there was a lot of identity in that. Then, did a little single parenting, and Joy and I met, and we formed a second family, and now everybody's off in different directions. Through this, you know, this is quite a period of being, speaking very personally now, of being an artisan, craftsman, in considering landscape design that as well. Went through another kind of religious awakening, all through the, you know about Subud, did she talk about Subud? Anyway, we belonged to a religious group all for a number of years.
And what was the name of that group?
Subud.
How do you spell
S-U-B-U-D.
It?
S-U-B-U-D.
She referred it to as the cult,
with a smile. The cult,
she said the cult, with a smile.
Yeah, we have similar thoughts about it. And there's a whole book in that.
But no one will write it until you all go around killing each other 20 years later. Then suddenly,
no danger of that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm referring to that thing in France.
Anyway, I started working in a soup kitchen, volunteering in a soup kitchen, and became very interested in working with people and engaging people on the street, and then became frustrated with the lack of relationship. And also started having some second thoughts about charity and seeing how charity worked. And but became interested in psychology and eventually decided to go to graduate school, sold our house to go to graduate school, and have graduated in 95, and now I'm in an internship now at the MFCC. As an MFC, it's a marriage family counselor.
Marriage and family counselor.
California license.
Right.
So I'm doing that.
Where did you go to graduate school?
Pacifica. Little, you know it?
Oh, yeah. But it's just for the record.
Okay.
And so now you're a licensed marriage and family
counselor. I'm not licensed yet.
Yeah.
I'm pre-licensed.
You're doing your internship.
Yeah.
So. Great.
Yeah. That's good. Okay.
And thus, in fact, you've ended up doing what almost all IBSers are doing, which is some form of public service.
Yeah, but I've spent years and years without, you know, and kind of came back to it.
But your instinct has, I don't know, even in the artisanship, there, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a service. Yeah.
It is a service in itself. Even the production of art is service. It's not, you're not doing it only for yourself.
It was for people, and it was for intended to enrich their lives.
So the trick is to enrich people's lives without patronizing them. This is the...
Yeah, or to just simply do a work that becomes... I mean, my view of therapy is... I mean, there's an outer frame that's about helping people, and but at a deeper level, it's about recognizing that your that process is one that simply goes on, and that while compassion is a big part of it, for me, actually deciding where people should go or what they should do is not it, and it's almost a, at times, an almost detached kind of attitude. I don't know if that's clear, but it's like helping is not a word that's like real big in what I'm doing, although other people's view of it is that. It's well, there's still like a helping engaging a presence or engaging.
Yeah,
a,
true. But it's still called a helping profession.
Yeah, it's definitely
anyway,
a helping profession.
It's what people call helping.
Yeah.
It's another issue.
Yeah.
Facilitating.
Yeah.
It's another way of.
Yeah.
You're dealing with process. You're facilitating where they go next. You're not taking them there yourself necessarily.
Mm-hmm. And, I'm doing kind of a bunch of things now too. One of the things that happened in graduate school is I became very interested in hands. And the psychology of hands, and I've become something of a palmist as well. I wrote a thesis on psychology of hands, meaning of hands. So I'm doing a little of that too, and then I'm working in a school. I'm working for the Allisaw School District out here as a counselor, which is apart from my internship. And then I see people in a bit of agency.
Well, another thing you missed on NPR was a founder of SAFE, you know, 1-800-SAFE was on NPR for an hour talking about her own experience as a battered woman and how battered women lack not just self-respect and other things, but no resources.
Uh-huh.
How even when agencies want to help, they can't get to a space where they can accept it, even if they could find it.
Uh-huh.
And how one day a superintendent of police or something was saying to her, "Boy, you know, this never happens to smart women like you," because she'd gone to Harvard Law School eventually and become a prosecutor. And she said, "I got to come out of the closet on this one," and began working outwardly to address those problems.
Mm.
So, as I said back then, there's a world of hurt out there, and if we all were slightly focused on it, it would all go away. It doesn't require all our attention, but instead, a few of us give all our attention, and the government gives all its attention to a few things, and the result is what I find on the radio in these days when they ask a sociologist or a psychologist why, he says, "Well, we could talk about that, but we're really looking at the root causes of those things, you know, the things that make for cultural unhappiness and frustration." And when I'm hearing that more frequently, and maybe that'll spread, people realize back what the 60s were about really was diagnosing a cultural illness.
Yeah.
That would underlay this, and that it's not just technology.
No, it's not.
And so it's going to be interesting. It's either that or become Unabombers, and we don't.
There's a war going on.
Yeah, it's a war, but look, people are seeing a whole bunch of different wars without realizing that there's a.
But my experience in East Salinas is really reminiscent of moving into a community where. And it's gang stuff. And it's not politicized, but it's
well, it's
there.
Not. It's not related to
it's
a
like,
wider political framework,
yeah,
but
it's like
political
pre,
within itself.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, in 75, you know, you felt going back to 75.
75.
By then you were probably deep in Elk.
Deep in Elk.
Deep in Elk. And, you know, the war in Vietnam ended. You know, Path at Lao won.
Was it 75?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember when we moved from Elk down here, but it was around then. Okay, 75.
And you were concerned about what might have happened to all the people you you worked with? You were as far removed from it, though, I think, in Elk as I was. I was in Europe and Asia, and it seemed like, you know, it was this thing happening on a flickering television.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like it was...
Yeah, it seemed far away.
Far away.
Yeah.
Did you feel a sense of relief to know that the war was over, or was it just one of concern and wonderment?
I think I felt relieved that it was over. Yeah, now I'm remembering more.
Well, I hate to create a recovered memory. In fact, I've never asked that question before. I've said, "How did you feel at that?"
Yeah.
And
no, I'm remembering. I had a good friend in Elk who worked with me as a gardener, and he was had gone the other route. He was a Vietnam veteran. He'd been a lieutenant and had a bullet spin around inside his helmet or something that really terrorized him. And He was a wonderful conversationalist and a poet. And I'm remembering, thinking I remember, I think I remember. I don't know. Now I'm lost.
If it comes back to you, I'll call you.
Yeah, okay.
And, well, we've been all over the place. This is great. Yeah. This is fun.
Yeah.
And, of course, because of Susan's pictures, I have such a clear picture.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't think I'm doing this justice because I can see it myself.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not going over it or, you know,
or
verbally, because I see the kiln and I see Susan with the women, you know, working with the women and driving people.
Yeah.
You know, in the vehicle and all that. But it wasn't such a long, strange trip. It's been. It was had its own.
I would really be curious if you write about this moral question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think you expressed it exactly. I mean, I was trying to get you to a space where you could describe it, and I think you kind of described it. It's ineffable to begin with. That's what a mystery is anyway.
Yeah.
It's ineffable. I think it's part of a wider cultural outlook that early volunteers took with them, that there were no contradictions.
I guess what I'm curious, though, are you finding that people went through a kind of awakening, or do they stay intact? And those of us who go in agonizing come out agonizing, and those who go in with their ideology intact come out.
Nobody was unaffected.
Yeah, but do they come out with the same Norman Rockwell kind of...
Well, I don't think anyone actually went in. I think that was a myth, too. Yeah, no, that's the whole point. I think, I mean, I talked to someone who was in Vietnam in 61, and he left like in 62 or something. And he said everything that happened, he could see happening. He knew this, everything was going to happen. And, you know, salt of the earth, the agriculturalist, you know. And I think that's the problem, finding a space so that the people who seemed more accepting of the way things were aren't stereotyped as, you know, from a particular political or religious or cultural outlook, because they were very varied. You know, I expected to meet a lot of people from Iowa when I was talking to certain, you know, the early people who were like agriculturalists.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite true. You know, a lot of them were quite suburban.
Mm-hmm.
And then I expected to find people, well, I didn't expect. There were certain assumptions.
Yes.
And I think some people went through it and developed qualms, and in retrospect had a lot of qualms, but felt on the balance that what they did was good in the sense that you've instructed it, that multicultural experiences are good, they're valuable. You can't not have them because it might be politically questionable at any given moment. And not only that, it didn't seem that questionable to begin with. And like in your case, it became more questionable. And then for some people, it looked crazy to begin with, but then it became morally unacceptable. People like Fred, Fred Branfman, and turned them into advocates, you know, and was a launching pad, you know, for a life of moral concern. But for others, all who served in Vietnam were radicalized in terms of human relations. And it largely determined the course of the rest of their lives. What they would do. I mean, a lot of them, I mean, for the Vietnamese group, you know, Laos is remote, but Vietnam remained very closely attached to the United States for a long time. Mm-hmm. Refugees, immigrant issues, boat people. The government needed, and states and cities need people with Vietnamese language skills.
Mm-hmm.
And these are some of the very few people who had it. The military didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And those that did stayed in the military or went on and wrote Vietnamese poetry. But it became a job for them. And after they left IBS, they stayed in Vietnam, but not with IBS. At USAID. For the most part, they got Fulbrights and things.
Mm-hmm.
There were some who went into USAID and some who resigned. Mm-hmm. Who, their IBS experience didn't radicalize them, but their experience in USAID did.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others, like the folks in Laos who joined USAID, who stayed comfortably in it all the way to the very end. And don't feel any regret because they simply were doing a small job the best they could, and this was going to happen, and it happened. And they used to call the Pathet Lao the bad guys, but, you know, like, well, we knew there were bad guys in the area, but, you know, it's a kind of way you deal. you know, it's a nice, innocent way of dealing with that particular problem. It's kind of humoresque. It's the way you deal with personal danger.
But it's not an
ideological danger.
Yeah.
You know, you talk a lot of veterans, not a lot of veterans, but a lot of people who ran the war, and you have all sorts of weird guilt trips and dodges that they're all in and out of, and on both sides of the war effort, against it and for it, and you know, aren't very honest about it. But the IPSers all seem to be fairly honest. And there's guilt and there's tears, and yet there's also a sense of pride. But I think it's awfully well balanced. But what I don't find are these American Gothic people who went in as American Gothic people, A, or people who were American Gothic people and stayed that way. Everybody grew from that experience, and I think as they started out fairly young. There are the older folk, like Pop Buell, who went out as older. There were very few of those, because it was the beginning of the program. And I need to interview more of them before I can pass judgment on them. You know, come up with a judgment. There's a guy named Mike Chilton I want to speak to, who was a very early advisor, a very early volunteer in 61. He lives in Oregon. I'm going to call him. He lives in Baker, which is practically Idaho. And I've got to talk to him. And hopefully we'll talk to more. Because the problem is, as the aid program, the USAID program grew, the manpower needs from about 1963 onward were so great that they had to go to people like you. In other words, people who already had some idea about Southeast Asia and knew that there was something happening there politically. Because before that, it was just another country. I mean, think of 1960. There were nothing but troubled third world countries in the world.
Yeah.
You know? And it wasn't an issue of war or peace or anything else. And it just wasn't an issue to that generation, that immediate post-war. There were people born in the 30s. It wasn't an issue to them. Sometimes, like, I ask their birth date and it won't be on it, we'll have to call them back. But the idea is that I think this is a very aware group of people. And I think to a lot of IVSers, in retrospect, it doesn't seem that way. That is, a lot of later IVSers think the earlier ones were more American Gothic types. And I think to a certain extent they're right, but they're also wrong. And we'll have to explore that. See, we don't know how we're going to organize it.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's by period, by a theme, by an experience. And
see, it's an interesting, to me, it's what you're doing is kind of fascinating, because it's an interesting exploration of American culture. And it's like taking an eyedropper. There's some self-selecting, or there are different selecting factors involved. But somehow it seems like the sampling is a curious one that may somehow speak to the way the culture is, I don't know.
Save that for the blurb on the back of the book.
Yeah.
That would be the best thing, I think, that could come of it. What I don't want it to be is a condemnation of American missionary activity or praising naive missionary activity.
Yeah.
You know? And it's hard finding the middle, because it was so politicized.
Yeah.
So I have to say.
Well, I think, you know, for me, there's a whole lot of other areas here, like the whole area of pacifism, in the sense that my impression of IVS was it was organized by pacifists, and that there were a number of pacifists. I didn't call myself a pacifist, although I may be quietistic or whatever, you know. But there were a number of people who were religiously pacifists who were brought into that. And the irony of bringing them into a war is kind of fascinating to me. I think Fred Scheidler was like that, you know, and that he was this victim, and he was being used in a forward area, you know, and it was, the intentions were anything but pacification, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, but what I'm struggling with is that if you have an existing government that you're giving developmental support,
that's all it is. It may sustain that government, so that means it's a political act.
Yeah.
But is it a counterinsurgent act?
See, it to is. Me,
it is implicitly. What I'd love to hear, and I hope we get, is USAID discussions with IBS, because I am not, have yet not found what may well be, which is that IBS was happy to provide these resources because they thought the path of Laos were bad. But on the other hand, when IBS people go out to Laos and they see these things that look like counterinsurgency, they're opposed to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, how can you be CIA when CIA throws you out of the country? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a tautology there. It's not meant to be that actually happen. But it did actually in Vietnam, when the United States government was no longer getting any benefit from IBS, and actually it was a debit, a horrible albatross. You know, they terminated the program. Now the question was it designed to in the first place, or was it designed to be rather generic? Then they saw some opportunities of using it very specifically, and then they found that it was backfiring. While IBS was going about its what it thought was its normal role. I'll give you a small example. IBS assigned people for refugee resettlement and refugee counseling and stuff like that. And one guy reports that he heard on a radio, is the IBS are in place, then we can move these villagers over there. In other words, they started counting on this resource the way they count on USAID or CIA or anyone else as part of this machine. And those that discovered that were really angry. And some IBS officials would say, come on, let's just finish this commitment, you know, get with a program. You know, it's no big deal, you're helping these people, you know. Others like Don Luce, you know, said, we're not going to be a party to this. But you're aligned. So that makes it. For me, I remember, I mean, because I knew about Don Luce then, you know, after the, you know, later in the war, not when I was draftable, but afterwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a moral purity to all that. And I still think there was. But what about for the people that, well, the moral purity wasn't so clear? Where, you know, the task is to find that space, as Eustace defined. Where did that myth or lack of clarity or their own clarity? And what I found in interviewing the ones that went into USAID is that they had their own clarity. And they don't have any regrets. And there's no possibility of guilt. It's not part of it. The world's a big place. Bad things happen even when you try to do good things. But if you don't try to do the good things, nothing can happen.
Well, okay, now, where are you speaking from here? Are you, you're...
Oh, the interview changes hands here. Go ahead.
Well, saying what, I can imagine saying what you're saying, but then I would ask, well, as an amateur psychologist, are you seeing evidence of the guilt? Are you seeing, you know, that there's this unconscious process at work here? I mean, are these people clear?
Some were pragmatic people who were always clear.
Yeah, okay.
Others were idealists that feel compromised a little bit, but were pragmatists enough to know in the balance. I think it's across the whole spectrum. In fact, I'd like to find that. I'd like to find that there was everything of everything, because that's the way people are. I'd hate to find out that everyone was American Gothic folk who were... Walt Coward, who was in Laos earlier, said the USAID thinks we're a bunch of religious nuts up on the Plain of Jars, you know, like that. And I haven't found any religious nuts yet, but I'm afraid that may be self-selected. The people responding to the questionnaire aren't religious nuts. And the early people who are older, someone identified recently, may be people who felt the IVS that they knew disappeared after 65, 66, and was taken over by people like you. And that's the dominant, you know, that's what IVS, so someone doing an oral history of the IVS would be prejudiced in favor of all those folk after 65, and there won't be any space for them. You know, the anti-war group, the COs, and they weren't any of those people. They didn't identify with that. And so they don't want to be part of a project that inevitably has to lean heavily, more heavily on that.
You're characterizing the pre-65.
I'd say that some of those people might feel that way, and if we don't reach them, that would be a big shame.
Well, just in speculating, how would you characterize them ideologically or?
No, there was no war. I don't know. But the point is, there was no war then.
I'm curious about the religious nut.
To their point.
I'm wondering if you look closely enough, you're just not going to find a religious nut, because that's just the way that, say, someone who's a pacifist is going to be categorized.
That's right, by other people.
Outside.
That's right.
Because I mean, one of the big educational aspects of this for me, mm-hmm. and this is like Harper's Ferry now, mm-hmm. is encountering people from other religious traditions, people who had a pacifist tradition or whatever, you know, because I improvised my CO thing. I did not have a religious backing.
Which is amazing.
I made it up.
Yeah.
And from my experience, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, it was definitely a sincere thing, mm-hmm. but I was taking an individual religious stance.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that these people from these different, like Quakers and so mm-hmm. on, were really very thoughtful, intelligent, very intelligent people. I didn't find any religious nuts. I found people of great, you know, who were of position, you know, who had moral positions mm-hmm. and so on. And I found that remarkable, because I really hadn't been in my experience, you know, mm-hmm. to find someone.
Well, IVS was very self-selective because, first of all, there are people who are interested in international service. They're not parochial.
Yeah.
They all have some facet of their background where mm-hmm. there's an openness to that experience. But the other thing is that IVS wasn't for Quakers, Mennonites, and Brethren. Those people had their own services.
True.
So IVS was something that people who didn't want to do that could do and still be consistent with their religious tradition, but be in what was essentially perceived as a secular.
Yeah.
You know, non-denominational, non-governmental organization. Yeah.
Yeah,
and in fact, you'd be thrown out of IVS if you were trying to proselytize.
Yeah.
So actually, they're not religious nuts up on the Plain of Jarn. So it couldn't be. Nothing could be, you know, more inaccurate than that. And that makes, you know, that's where all its complexity comes from. It's not. They're not. The people in it are not. And you mentioned pacifists. Actually, some of them said, "I wasn't a pacifist. I was a resistor. That is, I don't like war." Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean I don't believe in nonviolence necessarily.
Yeah.
It just means I don't think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
And many were not. I mean, there I just interviewed a machine gun carrying IVS. Now, he only had it for his own protection, and he never used it, never fired at anybody. But he didn't see there was anything odd about that. But he also said he was, you know, totally involved in the war. I mean, he was a refugee counselor, and there was a war going on. And you killed to survive if you had to, and the tracers were neat, and the adrenaline rush was fabulous. He was in the war. He wasn't in IVS. Mm-hmm. He was more in the war than in IVS, mm-hmm. and knew it. You know, You know, and was alone, though. I mean, there's no support, really. And nor did he actually want there to be. He liked experiencing that as part of his life. Mm-hmm. And has nothing to do with any of these things that for everybody else. That everybody else isn't. They want to experience things, but they don't want to die. They don't want to put them. I remember Chuck Cable said, "I wanted to be out there, and I want to see what the war was like, but I didn't actually want find myself in peril of my life every minute of the day." Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that, and a lot of it's generational. And as the war grew as a news item, you know, people became more curious.
Yeah.
Others weren't curious anymore. I'm a CO. I want to do some good over there while we're doing all this evil, you know, like that. And it's a fair.
You know, one of the difficulties in what you're doing, I mean, at least from my generation, is that so many of us are just disaffected from IBS as an organization. There's no attraction there,
mm-hmm.
and so you. I'm imagining that. I mean, I didn't respond. If I got the thing, I didn't respond just because I'm not really not noticing that much. I kind of glance at it and I put it aside, and that's what those folks are doing, and it all seems a little foreign, you know, and I don't quite understand what all they're doing. But I'm thinking of somebody like Lou Sitzer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I bet he's not on your list.
Well, the problem is I'm only looking at names that
are
on my list on my part of the country.
Yeah, but he's in California. You know, he's somebody I've been in contact with in recent years.
Where does he live?
Grass Valley, Nevada City.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you interview him?
No. No, he didn't respond.
Yeah, and I would imagine he didn't respond. Mm-hmm. I think he had a really hard experience with the organization and doesn't want anything. Now, I'm really just imagining.
Yes, right.
But doesn't want anything to do with those people, you know, because I think... Yeah, I think he was victimized in a way by it, you know. How about Annie Russell and Tom Russell and those people? I'm wondering if they're...
They're not on mine. Yeah, okay. There are about 15 people who said they did want to participate, but I don't know who they are. Yeah. I mean, I didn't memorize those names because I've not seen any of them.
But my curiosity is...
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know,
Well, let's get in touch, and why don't you talk to Lou?
I've lost touch with him.
Oh, you've lost touch with him? But he lives in Grass Valley? Well, I don't want to contact. Do me a favor. You know, call information in Grass Valley. You know, and how many Lou Sitzers are there in whatever county that's in? I don't know what that is. Because we don't want to approach anyone who didn't respond. And he may have responded. He may have said no. See, Don sent a letter out saying, if you don't respond to this letter and say no, they're showing up.
Oh.
So it didn't matter whether you filled that form out or not. If you didn't say no, well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. That's not true. We did observe that.
Someone else, I'm just trying to think of who his name is. I mean, I'm thinking about these people for... I can't think of their name now. Who was in the education part? There were like two groups. There was a rural development team, and there was a English teaching team.
But someone just read the form and said, oh, they're not interested in the English development form. I mean, the English people. And of course, half the IVS effort was in education, so... Obviously, we're interested in that. I mean, a lot of the questions we ask are political because they're handles. You see, we know the political history of IBS. Mm-hmm. We don't know the internal emotional history. And we get that, too. I mean,
where did the Kennedy assassination occur in all of this?
November of 63.
After Kennedy. Okay.
But a lot of people went. Because of that Kennedy spirit, but both before and after, and or at least that was a thread, you know, that led them to end up on that place. Others it didn't mean anything, and of course after 66, 67, it's the draft, and then it was always the draft. I mean, the draft was always a factor, because for the males, they would be drafted, and you're right, a lot of them were resistors. They didn't want to be in an army, and this was a way of doing that. Oddly enough, it wasn't really 99% sure that it was. And you could get a deferment of your service, but not necessarily get it, although almost everyone did. But people were drafted out of IBS.
Or were they?
Not many. I mean, one or two. Yeah. One volunteer joined the Army after Vietnam because he didn't count the voluntary service. So he was going to be sent to Vietnam. So he enlisted so that he would have some control over where he was, and the irony of that is that people did that all the time and they still went to Vietnam. But he didn't. But he had some language experience that nobody else had, of course. And other languages. Well, hey, keep these speculative ideas going, and I'll give you a call and say, you know, have you thought any more about this? And we'll add it, at least 20 minutes that we could put on the tape, because I mean, obviously you must be reflective. You're a marriage and family counselor. Yeah. And I really appreciate the time. It was a pleasure.